Hey there, it's Lars. Thanks for checking out the Lars Larson podcasting experience, and have a fantastic day.
It's Friday.
It's Friday. Woo!
Welcome to First Amendment Friday on the Lars Larson Show.
Thank God it's Friday.
Today, Lars puts you in the driver's seat. You talk about what you want to talk about.
Government is the problem.
No topic is off limits.
We will make America great again.
Call 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-HEY-LARS to speak your mind. Now, First Amendment Friday with Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It is my favorite day of the week, First Amendment Friday. We open up the phone lines and we let you send off to the United States of America. Join in some honestly provocative talk radio for a great country. Are doctors the ones to blame for the overprescription of painkillers, or is there another factor? I'll give you an alternate theory. Why do so many millennials want to travel instead of following the American dream? Maybe one reason is they're still living off mommy and daddy and they can afford to do it, where mommy and daddy cannot. There has long been a question of the time of whether or not we should privatize air traffic control in America. I'll talk about the best option for and against. Plus, one man is in legal trouble after a monkey took a selfie. And now PETA says the copyright for that selfie picture does not belong to the photographer. It belongs to the monkey. And make sure to vote in my quick poll. You'll find it at LarsLarson.com. We put up a fresh question every night, Monday through Friday. Would you feel safer in a town where everyone is required to own a gun? There is such a town in Colorado. They adopted that regulation as one that was intended to protect the town, and I think it's done a very good job. And in fact, if I've had people ask me, do you think we'd be better off if everyone in America had a gun? And I said, yeah. I mean, people like to ask these absolute questions because they think they're going to trip you up by suggesting that you will say, well, not everyone. No. If everyone in America, every adult in America, had a firearm, you would very quickly solve an awful lot of the crime problems of the major American cities. And when people worry, but what about the bad guys with guns? Yes, if you were foolish enough to allow convicted felons and domestic abusers and child abusers and people who'd been locked up in mental institutions under court order, if you were foolish enough to allow them or to require them to have a gun, I think that would be a largely and quickly self-correcting problem as well. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. While you're on my website, visit the trophy room at LarsLarson.com. Post a picture and a paragraph about your latest hunting or fishing adventure. I know I'm going to do it come this fall because I pulled a branch bull tag, so I should be able to take a shot at getting a great big elk, and I'm hoping to get a buck as well. So if I'm successful, I'll be posting a picture there. You should do it as well. In yesterday's quick poll, we asked you, should it be illegal to walk and text on busy public streets? I had no idea that the day we were actually talking about this, on Wednesday, Honolulu has passed a new regulation that makes it illegal to walk and text at the same time. I imagine there's going to be a certain amount of law enforcement discretion on that. They're not likely to write tickets to people who seem to be handling it responsibly, but they can write tickets now between $15 and $99 in the city of Honolulu if they catch you texting and walking at the same time. Do I think I want the government that much in my life? No, I don't. On the other hand, do I want to see people who are too foolish to stop doing it on their own walk out in front of my automobile? I'll tell you what, I've had too many close calls where people have their faces buried in their phones, and then they try to walk right out in front of you. I don't want to be responsible for taking the life of somebody who is too foolish to put down that phone. By the way, would you vote for Kid Rock for Senate? Robert Ritchie, which is his actual name, Kid Rock, very talented performer. I've never had the opportunity to talk to him, although we've invited him on the program. He hinted this week that he is running for the U.S. Senate next year in his home state of Michigan. Kid Rock has been a longtime Republican. He describes himself as having libertarian leanings. In the past, he's campaigned for Mitt Romney, Ben Carson, and President Trump. The rock star may be able to find some real support in Michigan. This is from Red Alert Politics. Given his loyalty to the state, he currently serves as a deputy reservist for the Oakley, Michigan Police Force, and he has worked extensively for military families in the state as well as around the country. He's the part owner of a microbrewery in the state, which produces badass beer served at local events and employs dozens of people. He has all the attributes of a real conservative. He's in a business that depends on merit and decides how much you're going to be paid based on merit and whether or not you're still going to be able to do that. And he's a small business owner, so he understands that as well. And there's the question posed, is it unconstitutional for the president to ban Twitter critics from his page? Well, that's the claim that's being made. There's a lawsuit that says that President Trump's Twitter account has become an important source of news and information and an important public forum. In an effort to suppress dissent in the forum, defendants have excluded or blocked Twitter users who have criticized the president or his policies. Now, we've never really had a situation like this before, where a president has the power to say to people who are on Twitter, who might be expressing opinions he doesn't agree with, that he could ban them from that page. But is that truly a violation of the First Amendment free speech rights of people in America? I tend to think that that lawsuit is more to gain attention than to do anything else. Oh, and by the way, I wanted to point out, you usually hear bad news from the Middle East, and there's been a lot of skepticism about whether or not the Trump administration could actually make some difference in the Middle East. Let me give you this good piece of news that's coming out of Israel this week. The Israelis and the Palestinians have come to a deal on water. Now, what a lot of you may or may not realize if you haven't visited Israel or the Middle East, I have a few times, is that most of the water, most of the power, most of the concrete, many of the necessities of life get into the Palestinian territory and the Gaza Strip, courtesy of Israel. Jason Greenblatt has now helped mediate a water deal as part of the Trump administration's efforts to revive the peace process in the Middle East. Do you know, this is such a good deal that the United States has said that it welcomes the agreement reached by the Palestinian Authority and the government of Israel. Israel will sell up to 8.7 billion gallons of water to Palestinians every year, and they will do it at a reduced rate. The water is a fraction of Palestinian needs, but it will bring some relief to areas that are suffering from chronic shortages, especially during a very hot summer. A third of the water will be delivered to the Gaza Strip, which is currently run by a terrorist group called Hamas. But even still, for those who like to criticize the Israelis for their actions, I think the Israelis have been very measured in their responses to the terrorism aimed at them. The fact that they don't cut off the water or cut off the power or cut off the other necessary supplies that are going to some of the people who are trying to kill them shows that they exhibit good faith when it comes to this kind of thing. Glad to get your calls at 866-439-5277. And a reminder on this Friday night, cybercrime is a big business, touches almost everyone. A recent FBI report says people across the country lost more than $1 billion to internet crimes and scams in 2015. Businesses that wire transfer payments have showed the biggest losses, followed by romance fraud, so-called, and goods ordered online but never received, that came in third place, the highest number of victims at more than 67,000. Someone's identity is stolen every 2 seconds. It can be stolen in ways you might not even detect if all you're doing is monitoring your credit. The thieves could sell your info on the dark web or get an online payday loan in your name. LifeLock detects a wide range of identity threats. If there's a problem, U.S.-based identity restoration specialists will work to fix it. Nobody can prevent all identity theft or monitor all transactions at all businesses. Act now and get the added protection of Norton Security free for the rest of the year, for the first year, when you bundle Norton and LifeLock together. Plus, for a limited time, you get a 15% discount off the first year of your LifeLock membership. I've had it for more than a decade. Call 1-800-LifeLock or go to LifeLock.com and use promo code LARSON15. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a First Amendment Friday night, and it's good to welcome back to the program Andrew Langer, who is the president of the Institute for Liberty. And usually I agree with Andrew, but I think tonight we might disagree. Andrew, I'll admit right up front, I'm not a private pilot. My dad always wanted me to learn how to fly. I have not. But I am a fan of the idea of privatizing our air traffic control system, even if it only moves it slightly out of government-provided services.
Well, see, and you and I can have this good conversation, because normally, Lars, I would agree with you that privatization, and which generally means getting government out of the realm of doing things that are non-governmental, is a good thing, and especially when you actually privatize something. But when we create these sort of quasi-governmental, quasi-corporate entities, especially when they're being run as nonprofit businesses, we get huge problems, right? Because you don't have the same incentives that a for-profit business has, while at the same time you lose the oversight and control that a government agency might otherwise have. So you wind up with things like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and Amtrak and the post office to some extent. And so we've got some real concerns with it.
Well, I have the same concerns you do about Amtrak, which is a giant financial failure. The Postal Service, which was supposedly, well, not really privatized, it's still officially a government agency, but it was supposed to be an independent government agency, and it was supposed to pay its own bills, and it can't pay those bills now. But in the case of air traffic control, when you talk about losing the oversight, the Congress still writes the laws under which the skies are governed. That is, the laws on how airlines are able to operate. The financial operations of airlines are still regulated by the SEC. I'm sure the FAA will still write rules and regulations for the way you fly airplanes and safety regulations and that sort of thing. But the practical side of simply guiding the planes through the sky from one airport to another, can't we get a benefit by having that go as proposed in the 21st Century Air Act, as it's called, into outside of the government and into a private nonprofit government corporation? Isn't there any benefit to that?
But this is the issue, right? I mean, it is this idea of, so when you privatize things, you know, you're hoping that the market forces, i.e. the things that drive people to strive to cut costs, and provide a better customer service opportunity. You hope that those forces go at work to create this really great enterprise. That's why we do this. And in addition to this whole idea of getting government out of the business of doing things that are non-governmental, the problem, of course, here is that you won't have that incentive in any case. And so, you know, we proponents at this point to two other entities. Because essentially what we're talking about here is that the air traffic control system would become a federally chartered private nonprofit corporation. And
right.
They point to two federally chartered nonprofit private corporations, the Red Cross and the U.S. Olympic Committee. And so, you know, when you look at see where I'm going here.
I know where you're going.
The problem, of course, is like, right, the Red Cross, which does some very good things, and again, operates under with a certain degree of oversight, but still turns to the federal government for reimbursement, despite the fact that it takes in, you know, millions of dollars in donations every year. It still has these massive mismanagement issues. So here's where you and I agree. We agree that the air traffic control system needs to be reformed. Congress can do that and still do it as an agency. In fact, this is sort of the mantle of the entire Trump administration, is to reform agencies and agency operations to get them to operate more efficiently. What I don't want to see is this sort of this massive nonprofit boondoggle created, which won't serve consumers or industry or the various stakeholder entities any better than what we have today. So that's where we come down.
Okay, and I don't necessarily disagree with you, but how do you get agencies to reform when you look at, for instance, the VA, which is a government-run agency, which does a very important function, and at this point has been doing it very, very poorly, in part because of its involvement with the government. Some of the agencies are some of the entities that I admire the most, private nonprofit hospital systems, often run by, you know, religious orders. That's at the base of their chartering. You know, they seem to do a very good job of doing a very technological and complicated function. And I would sooner trust say, a hospital system run by a Catholic order. I'm not Catholic, but they seem to do a very good job with schools and hospitals. I would sooner trust them with that function than either county-run hospitals, which seem to be notoriously bad, or ones that are run as for-profit entities, which, you know, they may have some advantages. But in this case, I could see, you know, providing air traffic control at the expense of the users, the flyer, the customers of the airlines and the airlines themselves, who are going to charge us anyway. So, you know, I just don't see getting that out under the government.
I agree with you in that regard. And you know, you have to remember, believe me, it's so funny you bring that up, because, you know, healthcare, being married to a physician, is something that is near and dear to my heart. And sort of looking at the way that nonprofit medical care is discharged and discharged incredibly well.
Yeah.
But part of it has to do with sort of the way that the rules can get written, that sort of which sort of are not relaxed per se, but sort of allow for choices to be made, as well as, you know, you still have competition between Catholic, you know, or religious-based nonprofit medical care providing agencies, and you know, competing still with the for-profit world. So you get those free market impulses that are at work there. The issue here, of course, is we can't have multiple, at least I don't think we can, and if someone can point that out to me, if we could have multiple air traffic control entities.
No.
Yes. So the problem then becomes, right, you have this monolithic entity that does not have the forces of competition driving it to maximize incentivization. Now, to go back to your initial question, which is how do you go about the reform, let's point out, of course, that the Trump administration just fired a whole bunch of folks at the VA in order to produce reform there.
Yep.
And so it does take the hard work of actually managing the agencies and doing what you say that you're going to do in terms of creating a new climate where reforms can happen. I agree with you wholeheartedly. The air traffic control system needs to be modernized. It needs to be upgraded. It needs to provide a 21st century service in the 21st century. But you do not need to sort of throw the baby out with the bathwater and create this quasi-governmental, quasi-private enterprise. Again, normally, 9 times out of 10, I would agree with you. 99 times out of 100, I would probably agree with you about privatization. But it's, you know, in this instance, we don't get the effects that we want to get. And I, you know, listen, I have great respect for my colleagues at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, my colleague Bob Poole at Reason. They do awesome work. I just think that they're wrong in this case.
The only thing I'd throw into that is, unlike all those other entities, there is a fairly small group of direct users, and those would be the airlines. And I assume that the airlines would push to make that system as efficient as possible, because it's a dollars and cents proposition for them. And they are at least, I guess, well-educated, technologically, you know, savvy users of the system. And that if they went to not the government or the Congress or a federal bureaucracy, but to a private nonprofit and said, look, we can do better and safer flying if you will operate this way, they might be able to affect a private nonprofit government chartered organization better than they can affect the vast bureaucracy of the federal government. I got about 30 seconds for your answer.
Now, listen, all I can say is anytime you have the largest actors in an industry trying to dictate policy, you get policy that skews to benefit them at the expense of other people. To me, it's the definition of cronyism. So, you know, I don't quite trust it in that regard. But listen, we all agree reforms need to happen. I just don't think this is the way to do it.
Andrew, it's a pleasure to have you on. Thanks for the work you do at the Institute for Liberty.
Thanks, Lars. Let's talk soon.
You bet. Have a great weekend. Coming up in a moment, a major American union is being sued by one state attorney general. We're going to tell you why that's so significant for union members everywhere.
The Lars Larson Show. Opinion alert. It's honestly provocative talk on the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Glad to have you with me on a First Amendment Friday. Naysayers go to the head of the line on this program every day of the week, but we especially follow that rule on Fridays. I wanted to say a couple of things about the gentleman who called in, who was a naysayer just before the top of the hour. I knew that we were going to run out of, we were going to run out of some time. But I thought Cassidy was wrong because I think we have taken away one of the incentives for folks in Oregon and the Northwest who are addicted to heroin to go out and get treatment. And I think he's wrong. I think this is going to be a colossal disaster. But then again, much of what comes out of the Democrat governments of Oregon and Washington are colossal disasters. Maxford Nelson joins me now, who's the director of labor policy for the Freedom Foundation. Max, it's good to have you back on the program.
Well, it's good to be on the program, Lars. Thanks for having me.
Tell me what's going on in this lawsuit with the SEIU, the Service Employees International Union, which I have always found to be one of the crazier union organizations out there. They're facing a lawsuit for campaign finance violations that I have a feeling the union is not going to tell its membership about. What's going on?
Well, you're absolutely right, Lars. SEIU is one of the most militantly progressive labor unions in the country right now. They're also one of the largest. And no surprise, they're very active in Washington State and in Oregon and all along the West Coast. And they are extensively involved in state and local political activity and elections. Now, the way SEIU is set up, in Washington at least, is they've got their various locals that represent employees in various sectors and industries. There's about half a dozen different locals in Washington that that do the actual collective bargaining and representational work. Then, of course, there's the national SEIU out in Washington, D.C., and, you know, the locals pay a certain percentage of the dues they collect from membership up to the national. Well, there's also the statewide level of the SEIU. In Washington, it's SEIU Council 14. And Council 14 consists of two folks. There's just two people on staff. And similarly, you know, to the national, they collect, you know, some money from each of the locals annually. And so they preside over a budget of, you know, $2 or $3 million a year. Well, in Washington State, their entire function, their entire purpose of Council 14 is to oversee, and this is their self-described mission, to oversee the joint political and legislative work of SEIU and Washington State. And so we did a bunch of research here earlier in 2017, and we were, you know, plowing through federal reports and documents and some of our campaign finance records with the State Public Disclosure Commission. And we were able to piece together that Council 14 spent in election years anyway, you know, up to 70, 80, 90% of its budget on political campaigns and political contributions. But it had failed to report any of its activity, any of its expenditures, to the State Public Disclosure Commission as required by law. So basically, it was operating as a political committee without any transparency, without any disclosure.
So they're violating the law, but on top of that, the message that if they're spending 70% of their money, their budget, on political campaigns, is that saying to all those SEIU members who probably are willing to pay union dues but don't want to have to pay more than they should, that 70% of their money is going to politics and not going to bargaining for a better contract for them?
Well, it's certainly something that SEIU does not want its membership aware of. And we hear time and time again from the employees that we're communicating with that they're being told by union membership, hey, we don't use any of your dues money on politics. You can contribute, you know, an extra in excess of your dues to our political fund, but we won't spend your dues money on politics, which is absolutely false. And this is a great example of that. And so basically, once we were able to package all of this together, we filed the results of our investigation and a formal complaint with the state attorney general's office. And we've got a really cool feature of our campaign finance laws in Washington that basically allows any citizen to put the attorney general's office on notice of campaign finance violations. And if the attorney general doesn't take action within 55 days, the citizen can then bring their own lawsuit on behalf of the state to enforce those laws. And so just this week, we found out that that the Attorney General's office in Washington, who is a Democrat elected with SEIU money, is actually filing litigation against Council 14 on the basis of our complaint for the about $9 million in unreported contributions and expenditures they've made. So huge news, really a big victory that we're very excited about.
Well, and it shows that those kinds of laws do work. That do you imagine that lawsuit would have been brought if it didn't? If failure to bring the lawsuit didn't bring the opportunity for a private sector person to bring it? Because I have a feeling that the Democrat attorney general is happier to bring the suit because he can guide it and perhaps even torpedo it, you know, from within, self-defeating lawsuits. Because we've seen attorneys general do that before. When they decide they want to win a case, they go after it hard. When they decide they want to lose a case, they're capable of doing that as well. And, you know, I don't know what's going to happen in this case, but do you think they would have brought the lawsuit if the law didn't afford the private sector to bring a lawsuit if the attorney general failed to?
No, I think you're probably right, Lars. Yeah, I think it would have been much less likely that the attorney general would have acted if we didn't have the ability to back up, you know, that litigation, that complaint with our own litigation. You know, this is the seventh time now that we've filed campaign finance litigation against a major labor union in Washington or one of their allies, and the attorney general has acted on that and brought suit. And the trend in the past, anyway, has been for the unions to settle right away. They don't want it to go to trial, but they settle right away with the attorney general's office. They negotiate, you know, a modest fine, you know, pay some attorney's fees and get off basically with a slap on the wrist. I'm sure they would much rather be negotiating a settlement agreement with an attorney general that they helped elect than with the Freedom Foundation. So there's still that component to it, but I think the violations here are so egregious and so clear. I think it's going to be very difficult, even for the attorney general, to let SEIU off with a slap on the wrist this time. We're hoping for significant penalties.
I'm talking to Maxford Nelson, who's the director of labor policy for the Freedom Foundation. So what if you go out as a union and spend, you know, multiple millions of dollars in illegally given campaign donations like this?
So the state campaign finance laws allow that the penalty can be up to the amount of the unreported funds. So in this case, that would be a maximum penalty of about $9 million. If it's found in the course of the litigation and the investigation that the failure to report was intentional, then the law provides that you can have actually up to treble damages in that case. So there was a very high-profile case recently that the Attorney General filed against a business group, the Grocery Manufacturers Association. Similar type of violation, similar amount of money involved, a little bit more than in this case. That did go to trial, and the AG was able to come up with an $18 million fine for about $12 million, $11 million in unreported activity.
Now, come on, Max. So, do you really expect that Bob Ferguson is going to go after the SEIU, his buddies and the, you know, the purple-shirted folks, that he's going to go after them for multiple millions of dollars in fines? Is that realistic?
I don't think so. The point of mentioning the grocery manufacturer's case is to show what is possible if you have the motivation to make it stick. So we will have to stack up whatever Ferguson's office comes up with against SEIU against what he does against other business groups that have committed similar violations. I do expect. I think you're absolutely right that the penalties will not be that significant. But I would be shocked. Quite frankly, if the attorney general wasn't able to get at least a $1 million penalty in this case,
although this does give us a good argument against Ferguson on his run for reelection. Max, I appreciate you coming on the program. I'm going to throw out the challenge: if any SEIU members want to call me and tell me when you see that your union has done these things, why don't you go to the next meeting and elect different people when the election opportunity comes up to head your union who don't break the law and put you at the penalty of you know, fines like this? Max, thanks for the work you do at Freedom Foundation.
My pleasure, Lars. Thanks.
You bet. Back in just a moment. Glad to get your phone calls and emails on a First Amendment Friday. 866-439-5277. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you all over the Pacific Northwest on the Radio Northwest Network. Glad to get your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk at LarsLarson.com. But I get a special opportunity here because sitting in studio with me is Iraq War veteran Michael Connor Humphreys. But a lot of you may know him a little bit better for something he did some time ago. It was a motion picture, and the older version of that character was, of course, played by somebody else. But the young Forrest Gump was played by Michael Connor Humphreys. Michael, it's good to see you in person.
How's it going, Lars?
It's going very well. Now, I'm sure you probably get tired of talking about your role in that movie all those years ago.
It depends on the circumstances. You know, it's kind of gone away a little bit over the years, but I kind of expected to, whenever I come to a new place, to, you know, meet new people and have to kind of go through the story again, but that's fine with me. Yeah, it's a good way to break the ice most of the time.
Well, I was glad that you reached out to us because you grew up in Mississippi, but you've now moved to the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah, I was saying I'm a big fan from our Super Talk station in Mississippi where we got you there, and I've been listening to
you
for years. And when I came out here, I just thought I couldn't pass up the opportunity to look you up. So,
well, and what brings you from, I mean, I was just in Mississippi, a month ago or so, because I went down to do some things in Louisiana.
Right.
And my wife and I like to drive around when we got some time, and so we checked out Louisiana, Mississippi, and we've been down there before. It's a beautiful part of the country. What brings you all this distance to the Northwest?
Well, I'm actually here kind of exploring employment opportunities. I actually finished school in a few months, and I do international relations is what I've been studying. Kind of just going to get that done and see what I can do as far as a career around here, and honestly, just this part of the country is so beautiful. I just wanted to kind of have some new scenery. Mississippi's great in a lot of ways, but, you know, I've been seeing it for years. So
it is a beautiful part of the
country. I wanted to try something different.
No, it's a beautiful part of the country.
It is.
Now, it's a little bit of a culture shock.
It is culture shock, yeah. And I kind of knew that. I've been out here before doing a little work several years ago, so I'm a little familiar with it already. But, yeah, I am coming from the opposite side of the country, and not just geographically, but in every way you could possibly imagine. But, I do enjoy the abundance and variety of culture here. So, you know, I find it cool that you just got a bunch of different ways of thinking and people expressing themselves around here, which is neat. So, but it is. Yeah, it's definitely different.
Well, your notoriety for that movie part that you played that so many people remember. I mean, that was a real cultural. That movie is the entirety of it, Peas and Carrots, is a cultural icon. But then you didn't say, well, now I'm going to be a Hollywood type. I'm just going to go to California. I'm going to seek out movie roles. You said, I'm going to go serve my country.
Yeah, and the thing with that, you know, obviously I was really young when I did the movie, and it was a really big one to be in, to only be in one movie, and that kind of thing does follow you around for your whole life. But I guess as a kid, my parents both, we didn't really at that time want to go spend years in L.A. trying to get into that industry where we were more comfortable where we were. So I thought I would look at that when I got older, and by the time I was old enough to start looking into that as a career, Iraq had started to happen, Afghanistan. I come from a military family, and I'd always kind of floated the idea of doing the Army. So about the time I was 18, 19, I decided to go ahead and join up, and I thought there wasn't possibly a better time to do it than, you know, while the wars were going on, so I could actually have some service in there.
Thank you for your service to America.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Now, tell people what you did. You took a tour in Iraq.
Yeah, I was Army, and I was stationed out of Germany, and then I did a tour in Iraq from 2006 to 2007 in Anbar, which, of course, you know, at that time,
dangerous.
Ramadi and everything. Yeah, that was like the big hot spot over there, still is. But, I was there for about a year and a half, and just at the high point of everything at that time. You know, that was that one phase of the war back then. Now they're in another phase. And it's kind of crazy because, like, the town that I was actually based out of, the place that I defended with my life, and I had friends die defending it, and I saw Iraqi soldiers die defending it. I actually watched that town on the news in 2014, 2015 get overrun by ISIL. I don't think they've even taken it back since then. If I'm not mistaken, it's HIT, which is to the west of Ramadi. I believe it's still under the control of the insurgency over there. So, I mean, it's hard to have been there and met the Iraqis in that town and actually have gotten to, you know, have personal relations with people and then know what's probably going on to them now. And you can't really put that stuff down when you come back, even years later.
What's your personal reaction to the idea that you did do that service? You put your life in harm's way to do that and accomplish all that was accomplished. I mean, in 2011, even President Obama, who I was not a fan of, said, this is a success story. We have a self-governing country.
Right.
And then we pulled all the troops out, and it all went back into a mess.
Yeah, there's two different sides to it. It's that the whole question of whether we should have been there to begin with is one thing, and that, to me, is kind of invalid at this point, because now that we're there, regardless of whether or not we should have been, you know, you got to have the right strategy. You can't pull everybody out in a situation like that. It's going to get unstable. It's like that everywhere in the Middle East, but they really probably should have kept more people in there for the time being. The American population, for the most part, wanted out. But most people are not that well informed about what's going on to begin with, you know, to make those kinds of decisions. So, there's a lot of political motivation that went on that got us out of there. And it's just kind of going the same way as it did in Vietnam or Afghanistan after the Russians or any of these other places. It takes so much time and investment to bring a place to a point of stability and compromise, too, which you don't have a lot of that, especially when you get into foreign policy and stuff and military policy. It's people are pretty hard line about which way they're going to go with it. So
I'm talking to Michael Connor Humphreys, who you might remember from Forrest Gump, who played the young Forrest Gump. So what was your MOS when you were there?
Infantry. Yeah. Yeah. I was only in there for about 3 to 4 years, the minimum stint. And I figured if you're going to be in the military, you might as well do like the hardest job there is or the most basic job. So be on the front lines. But yeah, I hesitate to say I enjoyed it because there's a lot of things that are not enjoyable, but it was probably the funnest thing I've ever done. And really, having done movies is great and all, but I really consider having been in the military the most significant thing I've ever done overall, you know, that's had the biggest impact. But
it won't surprise you to hear that almost all the veterans I talk to do say they liked being in the military. They did describe it as fun, no matter which conflict they were in the middle of.
Yeah, it's true. And I'm glad to be pursuing what I'm pursuing now, but I do regret every day not being in there anymore. And it's just, you know, the camaraderie and the professionalism. There's a number of things that draw me to it, but you know, I almost made career out of it, but there's a couple other things I want to try out too.
Okay, so let me ask you this. When you go into the military and then I know you do basic, then you do your MOS training, then you get assigned to where you're going.
Right.
When you show up, do you let people just figure out who Michael Connor Humphreys is?
My approach to that, generally speaking, I have avoided attention most of my life with that thing. That's just been my rule. And I knew when I was going in the Army that would be there would be a trick to avoiding that. So I just didn't say anything. I was about 3 weeks into basic training, and one of the drill sergeants figured it out eventually. And the kicker is that there was this one kid in there for the first 3 weeks who kept coming up to me, and he's like, you know, you look just like that kid that was in Forrest Gump. And I kept telling him, I was like, oh, I get that all the time, man. I was like, you know, I just happen to look like him. That's not me, though. And then he never believed a word I said after that once he actually found out. So, and then he thought I was an elf in the Lord of the Rings or something. I couldn't convince him otherwise. So,
Michael, do you have a website or a Facebook or anything you want to share?
Yeah, I've got an email address. It's michaelconnorhumphreys@gmail.com.
Very good.
Yep.
And then there's probably a private one so you can screen out of.
Yeah. I have a couple of different windows for that.
Michael, it's a pleasure. Thanks so
you
much.
You as well, Lars.
And thanks for your service to America. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show.